A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's been thinking about the tension between patriotism and criticism, using Israel as his case study. He starts with Ben-Gurion's line about becoming a normal country when Jewish thieves and prostitutes and the policemen who arrest them all do their business in Hebrew. For Daniel, that's not just about language. It's about whether a nation can tolerate being real instead of idealized. He's been living here 10 years, considers himself deeply patriotic, but also deeply critical of things like the broken rental market and government neglect. And he keeps running into this wall where critique gets framed as disloyalty, whether on religious grounds, strategic grounds, or nationalist grounds. His question is bigger than Israel, though. He wants to know how different countries define the boundary between constructive criticism and betrayal, and where that line should be.
This is exactly the kind of question where the specifics matter enormously, because patriotism is one of those words that does completely different work depending on who's holding it. Ben-Gurion's quote is fascinating as a starting point. He said that in the early years of the state, and what he was really doing was rejecting the idea that a Jewish state had to be morally pristine to justify its existence. He wanted the mess. He wanted Hebrew-speaking criminals because that meant you had a real society, not a propaganda poster.
And that's the thing Daniel's getting at. The propaganda impulse, what he calls Hasbara, keeps trying to present Israel as this flawless project, and in doing so, it actually undermines the very normalcy Ben-Gurion was after. You can't have Hebrew-speaking thieves if you're too busy insisting there are no thieves.
He was saying the mark of sovereignty isn't perfection, it's ordinariness. A country where things go wrong and people do bad things and institutions handle them. That's a country. A country that only ever puts out press releases about how virtuous it is. That's a brand.
What does Ben-Gurion's vision of normalcy have to do with patriotism today? Let's unpack the tension. Daniel identifies three lines of opposition he keeps running into when he criticizes Israeli policy. The religious objection, which draws on the biblical spies giving a bad report of the land. The strategic objection, don't give ammunition to enemies, and the nationalist objection, which simply equates dissent with disloyalty. Three different logics, same result, shut up.
Each one deserves its own examination because they operate differently. The strategic objection is probably the one you hear most in everyday conversation. The argument goes, there are enough people who hate Israel irrationally, as Daniel puts it, without Jews adding to the chorus. Why hand your enemies a quote they can use? And you can see the surface logic. If someone is trying to delegitimize your country's existence, you don't want to give them material.
The problem with that logic is it assumes your enemies need accurate material. They don't. They'll invent it if you don't provide it. And what you actually lose by staying silent on real problems is the ability to fix them. Daniel's rental market example is perfect here. If you can't talk about how broken the housing situation is because you're worried about what someone in Brussels might say, then the housing situation never improves. You've traded actual quality of life for a hypothetical PR win.
The rental market in Israel is genuinely dysfunctional. We've talked about this. Prices have been climbing for years, tenant protections are minimal, and there's a structural shortage that policy hasn't addressed. Daniel's point is that criticizing that isn't anti-Israel, it's pro-tenant. It's wanting the country to work better for the people who live in it. But in the current climate, even that gets read as disloyalty.
Which brings us to the nationalist objection, the one that equates patriotism with uncritical support. Daniel says he sees this especially on the right and far right, where there's an aggressive push to silence dissent about Israel's virtue. And he calls that reactionary, which I think is exactly right. It's a response to feeling besieged, but it ends up being self-defeating.
There's a knock-on effect here that's really important. When you make dissent taboo, it doesn't disappear. It goes underground or it radicalizes. If the only people willing to criticize the country are people who already hate it, then criticism becomes definitionally anti-patriotic, which pushes moderate critics toward more extreme positions. You create the very polarization you're afraid of.
That's the trap. The far right equates patriotism with uncritical support, so anyone who criticizes gets lumped in with genuine enemies, and eventually some of those critics decide that if they're going to be treated as enemies anyway, they might as well act like it. You radicalize your own moderate dissenters.
Let's dig into the Hasbara piece more specifically, because Daniel raised two examples that are worth examining closely. The first is the claim that the IDF is the most moral army in the world. The second is cherry-picking examples like Arab-Israeli Supreme Court justices while hiding systemic problems.
On the most moral army claim, Daniel's point is that it's inherently unverifiable. You can't measure morality on a scale and declare a winner. And by making a claim that's impossible to prove, you set yourself up for a credibility trap. Any documented violation becomes not just a problem, but a scandal, because it contradicts the perfection narrative.
It's not like the IDF doesn't have real mechanisms for accountability. The Military Advocate General's Corps does investigate violations. There are real procedures, real prosecutions. Those are verifiable facts. But when you wrap them in this unverifiable superlative, most moral, you actually undermine the credible part. Because now people hear most moral and think, well, that's propaganda, so maybe the accountability mechanisms are propaganda too.
It's a self-inflicted wound. If you said the IDF has a robust system for investigating its own violations, and here are the cases where it's done so, that's a defensible fact-based claim. It's not flashy, but it holds up. Most moral army in the world is flashy and collapses on contact with reality.
The research on this is pretty clear. When audiences detect inconsistency, when you claim perfection and they see imperfection, they don't just adjust the claim downward. They discount the entire narrative. So you've lost credibility on the things that were actually true.
Same dynamic with the cherry-picking. Daniel mentions Arab-Israeli Supreme Court justices as an example of something real that gets highlighted selectively. Yes, there are Arab justices on Israel's Supreme Court. That's noteworthy in a region where minority representation in high courts is rare. But if you lead with that while ignoring systemic discrimination in housing and employment, people notice the gap. They smell the curation.
The thing is, both facts can be true simultaneously. You could have Arab Supreme Court justices and discriminatory housing practices in the same country. That's not a contradiction, it's just a complicated reality. But propaganda hates complication. Propaganda wants a simple, flattering story, and the audience, sensing the simplification, distrusts the whole thing.
Hasbara, in trying to present an idealized Israel, actually makes the real Israel harder to defend. Because when you've spent decades claiming perfection, every honest admission of a problem feels like a betrayal rather than what it actually is, which is just...
Let's move to the religious objection, because this one operates on a completely different logic. Daniel mentions that some people object to criticism of Israel on explicitly biblical grounds, drawing on the story of the 12 spies in Numbers chapter 13. The spies go into Canaan, come back with a report about fortified cities and giants, and the people panic. For giving what the text calls a bad report of the land, they're punished severely.
The argument, as Daniel frames it, is that speaking badly about the land of Israel is heretical or antithetical to Jewish values. Policy critique gets reframed as a spiritual failing. You're not just wrong about the rental market. You're repeating the sin of the spies.
Which is a fascinating rhetorical move, because it takes a democratic question, should this policy change, and converts it into a theological one, are you faithful to the land? And once you've done that, the critic isn't just mistaken, they're sinful. Debate becomes heresy.
Daniel's distinction here is useful. He separates bad-mouthing the country from democratic critique. Bad-mouthing would be saying the land has no value, that the project is worthless, that nothing good can come from it. That's actually closer to what the spies did. They said, in essence, don't bother, it's not worth it. Democratic critique says the opposite. This project is so valuable that I want it to work better, and here's what's broken.
That distinction maps onto a deeper Jewish tradition that Daniel alludes to, the tradition of questioning an argument. I mean, Talmudic discourse is built on critique. The whole Enterprise is arguing about what's right and what's wrong and how to fix it. That's not anti-Jewish, it's the engine of Jewish intellectual life.
So the religious objection is actually in tension with a much older and more central Jewish practice, which is rigorous internal critique. You could argue that refusing to examine the country's flaws is what's really un-Jewish.
I'd be careful about going that far. You don't want to just invert the claim and say the religious critics are the real heretics. But you can certainly say that the tradition contains multiple strands, and the strand that forbids critique is not the only one, and arguably not the dominant one historically.
Let's not replace one absolutism with another. Which brings us to Daniel's medium position. He says critique is essential, but there's a point at which being overly critical becomes unhelpful, and the challenge is defining that line without resorting to censorship.
This is where it gets difficult, because once you say there's a line, everyone wants to be the one who draws it. The government wants to draw it right after the government is doing a fine job. The far left wants to draw it somewhere past the entire project is illegitimate. And Daniel's trying to find a position that says, I can believe the country is fundamentally legitimate and still think the current government is failing on social issues. And neither of those positions cancels out the other.
What he's describing is actually the normal condition of citizenship in a functioning democracy. You vote, you pay taxes, you complain about the potholes, you argue about policy, you fly the flag on Independence Day. None of that is contradictory. The contradiction only appears when you've defined patriotism as cheerleading.
This isn't just an Israeli problem. Let's zoom out and see how other nations navigate the same tension. Because Daniel's question is really about the universal dynamic, how do different countries define the boundary between constructive criticism and betrayal?
Daniel's from Ireland, so that's a natural comparison point. And Ireland has an interesting relationship with critical patriotism. The 2018 abortion referendum is a case study in this. You had a deeply Catholic country engaging in an intense internal debate about a core social issue, and the critique was profound. It went right to the foundations of Irish identity. And the result wasn't national collapse. The result was constitutional change that, by most accounts, strengthened the country's sense of itself as a modern democracy.
That's the counterexample to the strategic objection. Imagine if Irish advocates had said, don't criticize Ireland's abortion laws because it gives ammunition to anti-Irish voices. The laws would never have changed. The critique was the mechanism of improvement, and the country didn't fall apart. It arguably emerged more coherent because it had actually grappled with its contradictions.
The United States has been having this argument since its founding. Flag-waving versus protest. America love it or leave it. Versus the most patriotic thing you can do is demand better. Kneeling during the anthem, burning draft cards, the civil rights movement being called un-American. The pattern is consistent. Every generation has people who equate criticism with treason, and people who insist that criticism is the highest form of patriotism.
What's interesting is that the American case shows both sides of the dynamic. On one hand, the tradition of dissent is so baked into American identity that you can argue it is American patriotism. The founders were critics of the existing order. On the other hand, every wave of criticism generates a backlash that calls it unpatriotic. It's a cycle.
Japan is a useful contrast, much more conformist model, where criticism of the state or the national narrative is often seen as unpatriotic. Social cohesion is maintained partly through restraint on public dissent, and you get different trade-offs, high social trust, low crime, but also a political system that can be remarkably unresponsive to public dissatisfaction, because the dissatisfaction isn't channeled into loud critique.
Neither model is obviously superior in all dimensions. The Japanese approach produces stability but can stifle reform. The American approach produces dynamism but can tip into chaos. The question isn't which one is right, it's what trade-offs you're making.
Israel, in Daniel's analysis, is trending toward the more conformist pole, but with a twist. The conformism isn't cultural in the Japanese sense, it's reactive. It's a response to existential threat. The logic is, we're surrounded by enemies, so we can't afford internal division. Which is emotionally comprehensible, but practically counterproductive, because the internal divisions don't go away, they just get suppressed.
Suppression has costs. Daniel mentions the government's neglect of social issues, the rental market, cost of living, and his argument is that the taboo on criticism actually enables that neglect. If you can't criticize the government's housing policy without being called a traitor, then the government has no incentive to fix housing.
That's the practical payoff of this whole debate. It's not abstract. When critique is silenced, problems fester. The rental market doesn't get fixed because nobody can talk about how broken it is without being accused of giving ammunition to Israel's enemies. And meanwhile, actual Israelis, including the ones who call critics traitors, are paying too much for apartments with no security.
There's a clinical analogy here from my old life. A patient who refuses to tell you where it hurts because they don't want to seem weak, that patient doesn't get better. The symptom doesn't disappear just because you're not talking about it. It gets worse, and eventually it presents in a crisis.
That's the thing about Daniel's position that I think is hard to argue with. He's not saying the country's terrible. He's saying this specific thing. The rental market is broken, and we should fix it. That's not anti-Israel. It's not even particularly controversial if you strip away the rhetorical framing. It's just...
Where does that leave us? What can we actually do with this insight?
I think there are a couple of actionable takeaways here, and they apply well beyond Israel. The first is about distinguishing between critique of policy and critique of existence. When Daniel says the rental market is broken, he's critiquing policy. He's not saying the state shouldn't exist, but in the current climate, those two things get conflated constantly, and learning to recognize that conflation and push back on it is a skill. If someone says this housing regulation is failing, and the response is, "Why do you hate Israel?" That's the conflation in action.
It's worth naming that explicitly when you see it. I'm talking about rental law, not about the legitimacy of the state. Those are different conversations. It sounds simple, but actually saying it out loud changes the dynamic. It refuses the frame.
The second takeaway is for people engaged in advocacy, whether it's Hasbara or anything else. Daniel's point about verifiable claims is crucial. Credibility is built on honesty, not on cherry-picking. A country that admits its flaws is more trustworthy than one that claims perfection. And that's not just a moral argument, it's a practical one. Audiences are sophisticated. They detect curation. And when they do, they discount everything you've said, including the true parts.
The research backs this up. If you present a balanced picture, here's what we're proud of, here's what we're working on, people are more likely to trust you on both counts. The pride seems earned, and the problems seem manageable. If you present only the pride, people assume the problems must be catastrophic, because otherwise, why are you hiding them?
The third takeaway is what Daniel calls critical patriotism. Pick one issue in your country that needs improvement, and engage with it constructively, without abandoning your love for the nation. That's the medium position. It's not flashy. It doesn't make for good slogans, but it's how actual citizens in actual democracies make things better.
That's harder than it sounds, because it requires holding two things in your head at once. The country is fundamentally good and worth defending. The country has serious problems that need fixing. Both are true. The temptation is to collapse into one or the other. Either the country is perfect or it's irredeemable. But the actual work of citizenship is in the tension.
Which brings us back to Ben-Gurion. He wanted Hebrew-speaking thieves not because he celebrated crime, but because he wanted a real country, not a fantasy. The same applies to patriotism. It has to be real, not idealized. A patriotism that can't survive honest criticism isn't patriotism, it's branding. And branding is fragile. Reality isn't.
The open question I keep coming back to is whether a nation can survive without a shared narrative of exceptionalism. Because a lot of what we're talking about, the Hasbara impulse, the religious objection, the nationalist silencing of dissent, they're all attempts to protect a narrative of exceptionalism. Israel must be uniquely moral, uniquely justified, uniquely virtuous. And any criticism threatens that narrative. But what if you just drop the exceptionalism? What if you said, "We're a country like other countries. We do some things well and some things badly, and we're trying to do better."
That's the Ben-Gurion move, isn't it? Normalcy is the goal, not exceptionalism. A nation that can criticize itself honestly, that can hold love and critique simultaneously, that's rare. That would be something to be proud of.
As global polarization increases, this tension is only going to get more acute. Every country is going to face the question of whether it can tolerate internal critique without fracturing. Israel is a bellwether because the stakes are so high and the criticism is so intense. But the dynamic is universal.
Daniel's medium position. Critical but committed. Patriotic but honest. That's a model for how to navigate it. It's not glamorous. Nobody's going to put it on a poster. But it's how you build a country that actually works for the people who live in it, rather than the country that looks good in a brochure.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, linguists documenting Inuktitut in Greenland recorded single words that expressed what required entire sentences in European languages. For example, a single verb form could convey, "I am gradually beginning to understand it," a feature of polysynthetic morphology that remains one of the most compact information density systems ever measured in human language.
Inuktitut was doing in one word what takes me an entire podcast episode.
We could learn something.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own question about patriotism, criticism, or anything else that's been rattling around in your head, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My Weird Prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.